Talk Show. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is July 11, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here with us for the third and quite likely final installment of 1848, Springtime of the Jews. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. Now, when last we left off, we were on, I believe, page 142 of Webster.
Well, yeah, we've been reading Nestor Webster, the chapter called The Revolution of 1848 from her book World Revolution. We've seen that the same Jewish Illuminists that were behind the earlier French Revolution were also behind this one.
So they're just trying to finish what they didn't finish in the 1780s.
Well, right, and they more or less triangulated the working classes and some of the military to support them. The monarchy did not stay to fight. They just abdicated in favor of the socialists. And the socialists, or the Jewish Illuminists, depending on how you want to look at it, that they basically promised the French working classes the world, and again, they could not deliver. And that's where we're at now.
Well, did anyone ever think they were going to have any intention of delivering, let alone the ability to deliver?
It seems to me that, you know, every 4 years in this country, that there's a whole class of people that vote, that expect candidates to deliver, even though they're lied to election after election after election, they still somehow think this next election is going to be different.
Well, they never see it. They just a continuous stream of lies. They just see it as a one-time fluke that somehow happens again and again and again, where when they make the promise that they're going to give you somebody else's stuff, they're actually going to follow through on it, where they don't care since they've been elected. They don't have to deliver the other guy's stuff. They'll take it and keep it for themselves.
Well, right. It never seems to work out the way the campaign promises go down, that's for sure.
Isn't it mostly what the promises consist of? You know, I run for office and I promise Peter that I'm going to tax half of Paul's assets and distribute them to people such as Peter.
Right, and I've said it before. Livy, the Roman historian, wrote about the Roman Republic all the way down to the time of the Caesars. And he basically illustrated a point in history where when campaign promises were made from the state treasury, based on promises that would come out of the state treasury, those politicians were hung by the Roman people. They were lynched and they were hung. And that's what ancient Rome did. That was a real republic, because the people knew that when a politician was making a campaign promise to give somebody something, that it had to come from somebody else, because government cannot create wealth.
And they weren't interested in being a party to theft.
Well, absolutely not. And they were afraid that they were going to be the ones that it would be stolen from.
Well, if the government can steal from you to give to me, they can steal from me to give to someone else.
Absolutely. And it shouldn't be allowed at all, ever. But people
right.
in this country have been voting with their bellies for at least 100 years now.
All right. Would you like to pick up the reading?
Well, right. I'll continue right where we left off.
Okay.
What might not have been done with a people such as this, so filled with gay enthusiasm, well, she wrote that when gay meant happy, with noble patriotism, when gay was an emotion and not a brand for deviancy. So with noble patriotism, if only they had leaders worthy of them. But on one side, Louis Blanc, helpless and hesitating now that he was brought face to face with realities, pushing aside sane reforms in favor of unrealizable ideals, and on the other side, Blanqui, Proudhon, wild beasts crouching to spring, waiting to rend and destroy that very civilization for which the people were ready to sacrifice their all. Now, this is the same pattern we saw in the French Revolution and in the Kerensky government leading into the Lenin government, is we saw the revolution go into one stage of a government that was unmaintainable, usually a democracy or a republic, and then the next stage was anarchy, is it not?
Absolutely. They used the unstable government to bring about chaos, and then they promised the order of communism to save society from the chaos.
And this seems to be the same pattern as the Webster's describing, but we'll find out.
They intended the Kerensky regime to be very temporary.
Absolutely. But Louis Blanc, obsessed with his idea of working men's associations, led the people from the path of true reform into the wilderness. The national workshops, now working men's associate, that's no new idea. That's the guilds, the medieval guilds, the guilds of medieval Europe. It's as old as time. The national workshops, he afterwards declared, were a failure because they were not conducted on the socialistic lines he advocated, and the government refused to give him funds to put his own theories into practice. But as Mademoiselle d'Argault explains, when the government really refused to give Monsieur Blanc was a budget and a ministry which would have satisfied his ambitions. The government did provide Blanc with funds to start associations of working men on his own lines and gave him a perfectly free hand in organizing them. The first of these experiments was made at the Hotel de Clichy, which Monsieur Blanc was allowed to transform from a debtor's prison into an enormous national tailor's shop. He was then given capital free of interest. Subsistence money was advanced to the workers, and an order for 25,000 uniforms for the National Guards was placed by the government. That's the government tax and spend mentality that they have here, right? The government is going to try to spend its way into prosperity. It never works.
Well, they don't have an income.
Right.
How can they spend their way into prosperity?
The usual contractor's price for these uniforms was 11 francs each, a sum found sufficient to provide the profit of the master tailor, remuneration for his workshop and tools, interest on his capital and wages for the workmen. But now that the profits of the rapacious capitalists were to be eliminated, it was expected that a handsome balance would remain over after the cost of the materials had been defrayed, and this was to be divided equally amongst the workers. Unhappily, when the first order was completed, the cost proved to be far higher than under the old capitalistic system, and the uniforms worked out at 16 instead of 11 francs each. Moreover, though the principle of glory, love, and fraternity was so strong that the tailors worked 12 and 13 hours a day, and the same even on Sundays, the ragged new recruits to the army were kept waiting for so long for their uniforms that, driven to exasperation, they went several times to Clichy and quarreled violently with the tailors over the delay. This, says Mademoiselle d'Argault, was the origin of the scission between the people in blouses and the people in uniforms, which led at last to mortal combat. So they fought over uniforms.
Mm.
Louis Blanc's other experiment... Somehow that doesn't ring true with me. Somehow it has to be a little deeper than that. Louis Blanc's other experiments were attended with not much more success. His association of armchair makers dwindled in 1 year from 400 members to 20. Doesn't it sound like the Russian number one report and what happened to Russian industry in 1917?
Everybody was gone looking for food.
And out of 180 associations in all, only 10 survived until 1867. A further breach was brought about between the soldiers and the industrial workers by the attempt of the government to establish equality in the army. On the 14th of March, it had passed the decree ordering – that sounds like don't ask, don't tell. It passed the decree ordering the smartest battalions of the National Guards to renounce their distinctive uniforms and likewise all the insignia of superior rank. Now, we saw the same thing in Bolshevik Russia, didn't we?
And in fact, they even eventually made orders optional. There were no official ranks for officers, and then they had decisions decided by the democratic process of voting that resulted in horrendous casualties, so they brought back ranks and officers.
Right. That was all explained in the Russian No. 1 report, wasn't it? And you know, our army today does subtle little things that are really along the same lines, but they're not to the same extent. Well, like I remember about 12, 14 years ago maybe, under Bill Clinton, remember they issued all the Army black berets?
Yeah.
And decided that everybody would wear a black beret? And that's basically a it was a slap in the face to the green berets and the people that earned them. And it was it was basically a morale move aimed at equalization of all the troops. And in a subtle form of way. That's the way I see it. So the socialist agenda is basically the same everywhere, right?
So instead of having to earn a beret, here's a beret for you.
Well, exactly. That's exactly what happened. And we see it. You know, everybody gets the same medals, and everybody gets the same beret, and everybody gets the same reward, and we're all the same. And accomplishment means nothing.
So you get a unit citation. Now, if you're part of a unit, if you're a clerk, but you weren't going door to door shooting it out with the bad guys, you can still get that unit citation even though you weren't in the thick of the fighting. You were filling out forms 20 miles from the front.
Well, yeah, right. My son was in Iraq under all the major all the major battles. He was in practically all of them. And my brother, who was sitting on a ship in the Persian Gulf, got 3 combat ribbons. And my son really gives it to my brother over that.
I mean, what's the biggest risk on a ship? Bumping your head on the bulkhead?
Well, right, basically. Especially against Iraq, you know. It's not like Iraq has a huge navy that... Yeah, you know, 3 trawlers and a bass boat aren't much of a threat, right?
They have some skiff and they'll throw a harpoon at you.
Right. Okay. A further breach was brought about between the soldiers and the industrial workers by the attempt of the government to establish equality in the Army. On the 14th of March, it had passed a decree ordering the smartest battalions of the National Guards to renounce their distinctive uniforms. Okay, green berets, take them off. And likewise, all insignia of superior rank. The more preposterous still, the election of new officers was to be made henceforth by universal suffrage. The Bolshevik Revolution, 60 years before it happened. The result was, of course, an explosion of indignation amongst the soldiers. And on the 16th of March, a procession of 4,000 to 5,000 National Guards marched on the Hotel de Ville to protest against the decree. Here they encountered a crowd of workmen and young boys with whom they came into collision. Insults and blows were exchanged, and the breach between the bourgeois and the people was now definitely created. And this is exactly, you know, the American government today, the Bolshevik Revolution and 1848. You got people like Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer. These people have no idea what it's like to go into battle. They have no idea what military discipline and progress and expertise are all about. They have no idea of accomplishment in the field. They have no conception of valor. So they want to reward everybody the same, and we're all the same, and we all just vote and pick our next general, right?
And they think if you're a soldier and you were just flipping burgers in a kitchen unit, that somehow you're the same as the guy who was in a special forces unit,
right.
80 miles behind enemy lines.
Right, and the 120-pound woman who can't even pick up a rucksack, she's the same as the Marine who's busted his butt all his life to get to the point where he is and who works hard and who could probably pick the 120-pound woman up and run 5 miles with her. And they're equal, and they're equal on the back. It's ridiculous.
And I saw a video of MPs, I think, in Iraq. One was a woman, and she was trying to kick down a door. She kicked it 8 or 9 times without success. So then somebody told her to just step aside, and a man brought the door down in one kick.
Well, right, but, you know, that's equal opportunity. That's that's mandated equality. It doesn't work. It never works.
And
but
that entire
always,
unit was exposed while she was banging on the door.
We always see who the people are to promote it, and we always see the outcome. And seeing who's promoting it in our society today, we know, and they are the same people that promoted it in Bolshevik Russia and in France in 1848.
They're promoting the mentality that you can be more than you actually are or more than your place actually allows you to be.
Absolutely, because we're all equal. They insist on an equality that's impossible to achieve in reality.
Isn't that what Satan promised Eve, that she would be the equal of God?
Well, basically, yeah. I mean, it's an old trick. okay, this breach was necessary to the socialist leaders if they were to retain their ascendancy. In other words, they had to cause division. And the revolution was not to end in the peaceful amelioration of the workers' lot. It never does. Accordingly, they seized the opportunity offered by the popular excitement to organize a demonstration for the following day. And as in the first French Revolution, the people were ordered out en masse. A huge crowd was to assemble in the Palace de la Concorde and march to the Hotel de Ville in order to congratulate the members of the provisional government, who didn't deliver on any of their promises, and demand a postponement of the elections, which might possibly remove the socialists from power. There we have it. This program, naively drawn up by the socialists themselves, Louis Blanc, Caussidière, and Ledru Rollin, was issued to all the different districts of Paris on the evening of the 16th. But already the organizers of the procession found themselves outdistanced by the clubs acting under the orders of the secret societies, and whilst the people were being invited to the members of the provisional government to come and demonstrate in favor of their remaining in office, Blanqui was concerting another agitation for the purpose of ejecting them. So we see anarchy following the provisional government, just the way they planned it all the time. It was thus that, when the immense procession arrived at the Hotel de Ville on the 17th of March, Louis Blanc and his colleagues found themselves confronted not by congratulatory and admiring bands of workers, but by a hostile army at the head of which were found the enemies and rivals to power, Barbès, Blanqui, Cabet, Sobrière, and others, whose expression, says Louis Blanc, held something sinister. In vain, Louis Blanc took refuge in his habitual revolutionary eloquence, declaring that the only desire of the provisional government, was to march with the people, to live for them, if necessary, to die for them. The crowd, wearied of such protestations, in other words, tired of the bull, gave way to prolonged murmurs. The people, cried one of them, expect more than words. But words in the end prevailed, and floods of oratory poured forth by Ledru Rollin and Lamartine finally had the effect of calming the agitation of the crowd, which towards 5 o'clock in the afternoon gradually melted away to the cries of Vive Louis Blanc, Vive Ledru Rollin. So it was over for this guy, right? For this guy, and they won the crowd over. Caussidière afterwards described this day of March 17th as the pacific victory of the people by calm and reason. In reality, it was a victory for the socialists of the provisional government. From the people's point of view, the day had proved as abortive as most of the great days of the first revolution, in which they had acted simply as tools of political adventurers. The greater number of the workmen, says Mademoiselle d'Agault, who had joined spontaneously in a manifestation in a sincere and naive spirit of Republican fraternity, were persuaded that they had given the government a mark of respect and had defended them against royalist plots. For themselves, they had gained nothing but an increase of hostility on the part of the bourgeois, who had watched with growing anxiety the menacing aspect of the procession. The result of the day of March the 17th was to throw back irretrievably the cause of the Paris workmen. So that's what happens when the socialists win, right? So far, they had gained certain points in their program, the establishment of the social and democratic republic, the promise of universal suffrage at the coming elections, the recognition by the provisional government of the right to work and the application of this principle in the national workshops, which, however unsatisfactory from the point of view of the state, had relieved unemployment. Had the revolution ceased early in March before the passing of the impolitic decree concerning the National Guards, it must have ended in a triumph for the workers. But the action of the socialists in throwing this apple of discord between the people and the bourgeois turned the tide in favor of reaction. Not only in Paris, but all over the country, the display of force exhibited by the procession of March 17th created widespread alarm. The provinces had no intention of falling again as in 1793. Under the domination of the Paris populace and the strong conservative spirit was a rouse that boded ill for the success of socialist candidates at the elections. From this moment, writes Comtesse d'Agault, there begins for the proletariat a series of reverses in which it is to lose all the advantages it had won in a few hours, and of which it had made use generously, it is true, and with greatness, but without discernment or foresight. This was the whole cause of the working man's failure in 1848. Instead of acting on their own initiative, instead of pressing the advantages they had really gained, they allowed themselves to be led into fruitless agitation by a band of political charlatans who were mainly occupied in quarreling amongst themselves. Thus, while Louis Blanc continued to represent himself to the people with his usual eloquence as the sole representative of their cause, the partisans of Ledru Rollin, amongst them George Sand, the novelist, who's really a woman, and I believe a Jewish woman, but I could be wrong, intrigued to establish a revolutionary government under his dictatorship, and Blanqui stirred up the workmen to resist the convocation of the National Assembly. Meanwhile, Lamartine, seeing his own power waning, endeavored to frighten Ledru Rollin with visions of Blanqui sharpening his dagger in the background, and at the same time continued to confer secretly with Blanqui in the hope of winning him over to his side. Amidst all this confusion of plans, the people counted for nothing, but each faction hoped by a further popular manifestation to triumph finally over its rivals, the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. On the 16th of April, the people of Paris were once more summoned forth on a pretext of electing 14 officers for the staff of the army, according to the new decree of election by popular suffrage. At 10 o'clock in the morning, a procession of 8,000 working men assembled in the Champ de Mars, holding aloft their banners with socialist devices such as abolition of the exploitation of man by man, equality, organization of work, etc. This army, which had started out quite peaceably, now stirred up by Blanqui, increased to 40,000 and then proceeded to march on the Hotel de Ville, whereat a panic spread throughout the city. Scare news was passed from mouth to mouth. The Faubourg Saint-Antoine has risen in revolt. The communists have taken the Invalides. They are setting fire to it. 200,000 proletarians in arms are preparing to sack Paris. Some of the exclamations of scare. On arrival at the Place de Greve, before the entrance to the Hotel de Ville, a number of troops, however, were drawn up, and now the scission that had been created between the soldiers and the working men became again apparent. The inclination to fraternize with their comrades in blouses that earlier in the revolution had marked the attitude of the troops had changed to active hostility, and from their ranks arose the cry, "Down with the communists, down with Blanqui, down with Louis Blanc." The tide had turned irrevocably against the workers. As the dejected battalions of the industrial proletariat filed past the Hotel de Ville through the serried ranks of the soldiery and finally dispersed, no doubt remained that the day had ended in defeat, and it was to the socialists and the workers owed their humiliation. The working men had not on their own initiative assumed the menacing attitude that alarmed the citizens of Paris. They had not devised the truculent mottos inscribed upon their banners. It was Blanqui with his ferocious methods of agitation. It was Louis Blanc with his foolish theorizings who had turned their just demands for social reform into war on the community and created the gulf that yawned between the workmen and the rest of Paris. Up to the outbreak of the 1848 revolution, the bourgeois, as we have seen, had regarded the aspirations of the people with the greatest sympathy. The work of the socialists was to destroy this understanding and to consolidate not only the bourgeois, but the whole non-industrial population in a mass antagonistic to the workers. It is from this moment, and that's the class division that the Jews always play on, right? It is from this moment that we can date that narrowing down of the word people to signify only the industrial proletariat, the sense in which it has been used throughout by Marxian socialists and that has contributed so largely to the divorce between socialism and democracy.
Well, when they say Marxian socialists, what other kind are there? Are there socialists that believe in freedom? I would suggest no.
Well, the word socialist has been used also in several political movements for their own aims. I mean, Hitler used the word National Socialist, but his definition of socialist was very different from Marx.
It was a radically different definition, like you just said. It wasn't, they weren't Marxists at all. It was just
right.
A name.
Hitler would never redistribute wealth.
But the people today who call themselves socialists, whatever flavor or variety they are, they're basically all Marxists.
Yes, they are. The 16th of April was followed by a great wave of reaction in all quarters of the city. The authors of the manifestation became the objects of indignant denunciations. A furious crowd carried a coffin beneath the window of Cabet. One half of Paris, wrote the prefect of the police, wishes to imprison the other. Even the allies of the socialists were suddenly smitten with misgivings, and it was George Sand, the disciple of Babeuf and Pierre Leroux, who was believed to have written these words in the Bulletins de la République for the 20th of April, quote, "As to the communists against whom so many cries of reprobation and of anger have been heard, they were not worth the trouble of a demonstration. That a little number of sectarians should preach the chimerical establishment of the impossible equality of fortunes need not surprise or alarm one. At all periods, misguided minds have pursued the realization of this dream without ever attaining it." The reaction was not confined to Paris alone. All over France, the tide turned irrevocably against socialism, and in the elections that followed, the people showed themselves overwhelmingly in favor of the moderates. But the revolutionaries had gained one point, namely that they had put an end to what Marx described as the charlatanry of universal fraternity. And the gulf between the industrial proletariat and the rest of the nation yawned more widely than ever. When the new National Assembly met on the 4th of May, the extremists, Proudhon, Cabet, Louis Blanc, and Blanqui, were all rejected by the electors, as also the labor candidates in favor of communism, who had been put forward by the Committee of the Luxembourg. And it was Lamartine who now received the plaudits of the crowd. This was largely owing to the attitude of Louis Blanc, who had made it clear that he aimed at nothing less than the absolute domination of the proletariat, a proposition that, placed before a spirited nation possessing an energetic and intelligent bourgeois, must necessarily encounter determined opposition. Unless you're here in America. Louis Blanc, moreover, possessed the irritating characteristic common to many socialists of imagining that he alone was animated by sincere love for the people, and his discourse to the assembly on the 10th of May, again demanding a ministry of work in progress, was so tinged with this peculiar form of egoism as to provoke cries of protest. Finally, the whole assembly rose in a body, whilst from all sides shouts went up, "You have not the monopoly of love for the people. We are all here for the social question. We have all come in the name of the people. The whole assembly is here to defend the rights of the people." The new assembly thus found itself crushed between two forces. On one hand, the bourgeois rendered the intractable by the menace of communism. On the other, the revolutionaries who, now legally excluded from the government, were obliged to cast about for a further pretext to stir up the people. This was provided by a revolt in Poland, which the Prussian troops had ruthlessly suppressed on the 5th of May, and the working men of Paris were summoned to assemble in their thousands as a protest against the display of arbitrary authority.
Doesn't this happen all the time today? Something that has nothing to do with the people who are protesting, and they just gather in the streets because they were told to be there.
Well, right, and it's always for some noble cause or other, that's a major distraction
or,
that has nothing to do with the state of the people at hand.
Or some Kaffir in South Africa gets bumped on the head by police when he's trying to burn a building down, and the next thing you know, they're calling for sanctions against South Africa.
Well, right. Every time there's a crisis that's going to interrupt the plot of the Jews, some distraction pops up that's unrelated, that draws all the attention, and all the attention of the people is drawn away from the Jews and towards the distraction.
And they always seem to get tens of thousands of people in the street on a moment's notice, and they would have us believe it's a spontaneous uprising.
Incredible.
We know better.
Accordingly, on the 13th, a procession of 5,000 to 6,000 people, led by Sobriere and Huber, a professional agitator of equivocal antecedents, marched to the Palace de la Concorde shouting, the Place de la Concorde shouting, Vive la Pologne, long live Poland. The working men in the crowd, who had started out in all good faith to agitate, as they had been told to do, in favor of oppressed Poland, were animated by no revolutionary intentions and never dreamt of overthrowing the assembly elected by universal suffrage. But, as usual, agents of disorder had mingled in their ranks, strangers of sinister appearance, ready to side either with police or mob in order to provoke a riot. Well-dressed women, not of the people, were observed inciting the crowd to violence. Do you think she means Jews?
Quite likely.
Their appearance, not of the people, aliens.
And they're well-dressed.
Yes.
At the bridge, have money for those kind of clothes?
At the bridge of the Concorde, the procession seemed to hesitate, but Blanqui, now placing himself at its head, cried loudly, "Forward!" And the whole mass surged towards the palace occupied by the assembly. The small number of National Guards assembled proved powerless to stem the oncoming tide of 150,000 men and women, which pressed onwards with such force that a number of people were crushed to death at the entrance of the palace. It was then that Lamartine, braver than his predecessors, the revolutionaries of 1792, came forward out of the assembly and faced the people. "Citizen Lamartine," said one of the leaders, La Viron, "we have come to read a petition to the assembly in the favor of Poland." "You shall not pass," Lamartine answered imperiously. "By what right will you prevent us from passing? We are the people. Too long you have made fine phrases. The people want something besides phrases. They wish to go themselves to the assembly and signify their wishes." How true was the word uttered by a voice in the crowd at this juncture. "Unhappy ones, what are you doing? You are throwing back the cause of liberty for more than a century." In vain the men who raised the storm now tried to quell it. Whilst the crowd pressed onwards into the hall of the assembly, Thomas, Raspail, Barbez, Ledru Rollin, Bouchez, Louis Blanc struggled amidst the suffocating heat of the May day and the odor of massed humanity to make their voices heard. Louis Blanc at the table declared that the people by their cries had violated their own sovereignty. The crowd responded with shouts of Vive la Pologne, long live Poland. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that word right. Vive la Organisation du Travail. Louis Blanc, attacked with the weapon he himself had forged, was reduced to impotence. It was no longer the theorist who had deluded them with words that the people demanded, but Blanqui, the man of action, the instigator of violence and fury. "Blanqui, where is Blanqui? We want Blanqui," was the cry of the multitude. And instantly, borne on the shoulders of the crowd, the strange figure of the famous agitator appeared. A little man, prematurely bent, he must be a Jew, with wild eyes darting flame from hollows deep sunk in the sickly pallor of his face, with black hair shaved close like a monk's, his black coat buttoned up to meet his black tie, his hands encased in black gloves. And at this sinister vision, a silence fell upon the crowd. Blanqui, suiting himself to the temper of his audience, thereupon delivered a harangue demanding that France should immediately declare war on Europe for the deliverance of Poland.
Wait, declare war on Europe? What has Europe done against Poland?
Well, it was Prussia that had the it was the Prussian soldiers.
So
that,
the answer is to declare war on every other country in Europe.
Well, right. I mean, that's the socialist Jewish takeover of Europe. I mean, here they try to agitate it.
And I found a picture of Louis Blanc that proves he's at least a 32nd degree Mason, since he's doing the Masonic hand sign with his hand in his coat. And I found out too that he wasn't actually born in France. We may have covered it. He was born in Madrid. His father held the post of Inspector General of Finance under Joseph Bonaparte. So there's a few strikes against him.
Yeah, about six. Truly a strange measure for the relief of public misery in Paris. Demanding war on Poland would not relieve misery in Paris. Meanwhile, Louis Blanc, or demanding war on Europe would not relieve misery in Paris. Meanwhile, Louis Blanc, with the Polish flag thrust into his hands, was making a valiant effort to recover his popularity. It's weird how Poland was also used to agitate World War II. An eloquent discourse on the sovereignty of the people had at last the desired effect, and amidst cries of "Long live Louis Blanc, long live the Social and Democratic Republic," he too was hoisted on the soldiers of the people and carried in triumph. But the emotion of the moment proved too great for the frail body. Louis Blanc, his face streaming with perspiration, attempted in vain to address the crowd, but no sound came from his lips, and finally, lowered to earth, he fell fainting on a seat. The dementia of the crowd, urged on by the clubbists, now reached its height. Whilst Barbès vainly attempted to deliver a speech, the tribune was assailed by a group of maniacs who with clenched fists threatened each other and drowned his voice in tumultuous cries. To add to the confusion, the galleries began to break down under the weight of the increasing crowd, and a bursting water tank flooded the corridor. At this juncture, Huber, who had likewise fallen into a long swoon, suddenly recovered consciousness, and mounting the tribune, declared in a voice of thunder that the assembly was dissolved in the name of the people. At the same moment, Buchez was flung out of his seat, Louis Blanc was driven by the crowd out onto the Esplanade of the Invalides, Raspail fainted on the lawn, Sobriet was carried in triumph by the workmen, and Huber disappeared. Then followed the inevitable reaction. The troops arrived on the scene and dispersed the crowd. Barbès was arrested. Louis Blanc, with tumbled hair and torn clothes, succeeded in escaping from the National Guards and took refuge in the assembly, only to find himself assailed with cries of indignation. "You always talk of yourself. You have no heart." Whilst these extraordinary scenes had been taking place at the assembly, another crowd of 200 people had invaded the prefecture of police, where Caussidière, following the example of Pétion on the 10th of August, remained discreetly waiting to see which way the tide turned before deciding on the course he should take. Faced by an angry mob of insurgents, the wretched Caussidière, hitherto in the vanguard of revolution, now began to talk of constitutional authority and threatened to run a rebel through with the body of his saber. With the aid of the Republican Guard, the prefecture of police was finally evacuated, and throughout Paris the troops set about restoring order. "The repression," writes the Comtesse de Gault, "is without pity because the attack has been terrible." Words ever to be remembered by the makers of revolution. The fiercer the onslaught, the fiercer must be the resistance. And anarchy can only end in despotism, which we see it is the Jewish plan anyway. Even the revolutionary leaders are obliged to admit the reactionary effects of May the 15th, and the people themselves, always impressed by a display of authority, sided with the victors. When on the 16th day of May the arrested conspirators leave for Vincennes, they hear, on going through the Faubourg Saint-Antoine, the imprecations of the crowd of men, women, and children who, in spite of the extreme heat of the day, follow the carriages with insults in their mouths as far as the first houses of Vincennes. But this revulsion of popular feeling was only momentary. Before long, the socialists had reestablished their ascendancy over the people. In the by-elections on June the 5th, Pierre Leroux, Proudhon, and Caussidière were all successful, and the situation was further complicated by the election of Louis Napoleon Bonaparte. It was now that the imperialist schemes of the Bonapartists first became apparent, and that the cry of "Vive l'Empereur" was first heard. The crowds of this faction, the leaders of this faction, no less than those of the socialists, realized that the overthrow of the existing government must be brought about by a popular insurrection, and the usual weapon of class hatred was employed by both with equal unscrupulousness. Side by side with the hawkers of such gutter press journals as the Robespierre, the Père Duchesne, the Caramagnol, the Journal de la Canal, the vendors of the Napoleon Republicain, pressed their wares on the soldiers, warning them that the bourgeois terror would represent them as the murderers of their brothers and invoking the red flag of social revolution. The government elected by the system of universal suffrage so long demanded thus found itself between two fires, and the whole revolutionary movement turned into a contest between the warring political parties. The industrial situation had now become chaotic. Trade was paralyzed by the feeling of general insecurity and by continual strikes of workmen, whilst the men employed in the national workshops showed an increasing tendency to revolt. This method of absorbing unemployed labor had, as we have seen, from the beginning proved a failure. And at last, after a vain attempt to improve matters by dismissing the provincial workmen who had crowded into Paris and by reintroducing the system of piecework, the government announced its intention of abolishing the national workshops. A decree to this effect was passed on the 21st of June and inevitably brought about the final crisis. On the evening of the same day, bands of workmen again assembled, and to the rival cries of Vive Barbès and Vive Napoleon, planned a fresh demonstration. Then followed the three fearful days of June the 22nd to the 25th. Barricades were once more erected in the streets, and war to the knife was declared on a republic. As in every outbreak of the world revolution, the insurgents were composed of warring elements, all resolved to destroy the existing order, and all animated by opposing aims. Thus, according to the report of Panis, the head of the Division for General Security, the crowds that took part in the insurrection included, besides the workmen driven by hunger and despair to revolt, a number of honest and credulous people duped by the agitators, who were communists, dreamers of a utopia amongst which each has his system and disagreeing with each other. Legitimists demanding the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty in the person of the Duc de Chambord, Bonapartists, partisans of a regency, and finally, the scum of all parties, convicts and wastrels. In a word, the enemies of all societies, men vowed by instinct to ideas of insurrection, theft, and pillage. Against this terrible army, the troops, led by the generals Cavaignac and La Morissiere.
And isn't that true today? They always bring in the scum of the earth to their demonstrations.
Well, the Jews always enlist the scum to do their bidding.
Often they just give them free alcohol and they say, be here at this time, or here you get a free meal or a free beer or a free cup of coffee or whatever.
Well, that's how they get Negroes to vote 4 or 5 times in elections here. That's how they enlisted the scum of the markets to beat down Paul and the apostles, right? I mean, we see that right in the book of Acts. In Thessalonica that happened. The Jews went and got the scum from the markets to do their bidding. They do it every time. And that's here, we're told that the communists did that. And we know who the communists are. Okay. It is unnecessary to follow the French Revolution of 1848 through its final political stages. The election of Prince Louis Napoleon to the presidency of the Republic in December the same year, the coup d'etat carried out by him 3 years later, on December 2nd, 1851, by which the Constitution of 1848 was overthrown, and finally, the proclamation of the Empire on December 10th, 1852, with the prince as Napoleon III at its head. Throughout this period, the fire of social revolution could only smolder feebly, and with the ascension of the emperor was temporarily extinguished in France. The regime that followed, like that which succeeded to the first French Revolution, was one of absolute repression. The socialist leaders were arrested. No less than 25,000 prisoners were taken by the government, and a great number deported without trial. Where would you deport 25,000 French Jews to at this time? Madagascar. I'm taking a stab.
Poland, Algeria.
Germany. How about Germany?
A lot of them went to Algeria.
At this time? Okay.
I believe so, since the French were starting to make inroads into Algeria or North Africa and various other portions of maybe the French Caribbean colonies.
Well, they were making inroads since the days of the first French Revolution, and that's when they were in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that to try to compete with the British Empire. But
interestingly enough, all the Jews in Algeria, despite having French citizenship, they advocated in favor of the Islamic radicals and the communists rising to power in Algeria. They were part of the anti-colonial movement, and they basically tagged the 2 million strong white French colony of Algeria, and then they just left the country after it was ruined.
Well, that's what we get for not knowing history. The Jews will always side with their Arab brothers against white Europeans.
I mean, they lived there too, and afterwards they were no longer welcome since the Muslims didn't want them hanging around, so they had to leave. Most of them went to Israel.
The regime that followed, like that which succeeded to the first French Revolution, was one of absolute repression. The socialist leaders were arrested, no less than 25,000 prisoners were taken by the government, and a great number deported without trial. At the same time, the secret societies were put down with an iron hand. All the liberties guaranteed to the French people, including the liberty of the press, were abolished by the Constitution of 1852, and this despotism was accepted by a majority of 7 million to 600,000 votes. The people got tired of the crap. They got tired of the agitators. For as in 1800, the nation, wearied of revolution, was ready to throw itself at the feet of a strong man who would restore order and give it peace once more. The revolution of 1848 thus ended in the total defeat of the workers. I think it would be the defeat of the Jews, but who knows. And for this, at least the Marxist Jews, and for this it is impossible to deny that the principal blame lay with the socialist leaders, above all with Louis Blanc. It is only just to recognize the excellent intentions of the man who devoted all his energies to the reorganization of labor on an ideal system, yet it must surely be admitted that the social experiments of this kind can only be judged by results. I'm surprised Nestor Webster actually lauds him here. The scientist who fails in a laboratory experiment may be pardoned for failure, but in the case of men who juggle with human lives, failure is crime. If a duke were to invent a novel system of drainage and, without assuring himself of its efficacy, were to install it in all his tenants' cottages, thereby killing them off by diphtheria, he would not be regarded as a noble enthusiast whose only crime was excess of zeal, but as a criminal fool for whom no mercy should be demanded. Why, then, should reckless venture, merely because they are conducted in the name of socialism, ensure the immunity of their authors? Louis Blanc may well have been a sincere and well-meaning man. The fact remains that throughout his application of impracticable schemes and obstinate belief in his own infallibility, he led the working classes to disaster. No one has recognized this truth more clearly than the anarchist Proudhon, who in these words has apportioned to this dangerous dreamer the blame he so truly deserves. Quote, "A great responsibility will rest in history on Louis Blanc. It was he who at the Luxembourg with his riddle, equality, fraternity, liberty, and with his abracadabra, everyone according to his strength, to everyone according to his needs, Marxism, began that miserable opposition of ideologies to ideas, and who roused common sense against socialism. He thought himself the bee of the revolution, and he was only the grasshopper. May he at last, after having poisoned the working men with his absurd formulas, bring to the cause of the proletariat, which on the day of error fell into his feeble hands, the obol of his abstention and his silence." You want to pick it up from here?
All right, and I'd just like to point out, too, that in regards to the events of 1848, your Wikipedia says, "It seems to have been largely unplanned, not particularly bloody, and indisputably a failure," referring to 15 May 1848, We were certainly planned. We've just shown that, haven't we?
Well, right. It was very much planned, but the revolution was planned. However, they had no real plan for government after it succeeded.
Okay, so I'm just picking it up from but a further reproach.
Yes.
But a further reproach to be brought against Louis Blanc and his colleagues of 1848 is their habit of perpetually reverting to the past. Let us respect the past, said Victor Hugo, provided it is content to be dead. But if it wishes to be alive, we must attack it and try to kill it. Socialists who are quite willing to apply this maxim to the noblest traditions of the past reject it when it is a matter of reviving exploded, subversive doctrines or methods. So the men of 1848, instead of considering the needs of the present hour, instead of pressing forward to more enlightened schemes of social reform, persisted in hearkening back eternally to the principles of the first French Revolution. Soaked in the doctrines of their revolutionary predecessors, all craved to emulate them. And thus, the so-called popular demonstrations organized by them in Paris between February and June of 1848 were directly modeled on those of 1789 to 1792. On this point, both Marx and Proudhon are in accord. The revolution of 1848, says Marx, could do nothing better than parody first 1789 and then the revolutionary tradition of 1793 to 1795. And Proudhon covers with ridicule the manner in which the Sauverners of 1793 were constantly evoked by the leaders. Oh, I'm sorry, souvenirs, I misread that. It was a universal mania, Mademoiselle de Agoulay observes likewise. From the 24th of February onwards, to refer everything back to our first revolution. The failure of 1848 lay, therefore, not in overzeal for progress, but in reactionaries, in blind attachment to the past and dead traditions. Don't they always blame it on reactionaries?
It seems to me, but it seems to me that the reactionaries here are those who want to go back to the revolution, the first French Revolution.
The outbreak of revolution in Paris had given the signal for the European conflagration. On the 1st of March, insurrection began in Baden. On the 12th, in Vienna. On the 13th, riots took place in Berlin. On the 18th, a rising in Milan. On the 20th, in Parma. And on the 22nd, a republic was declared in Venice. On the 10th of April, a Chartist demonstration was organized in London. On the 7th of May, troubles began in Spain. On the 15th, in Naples. And during the course of the year, no less than 64 outbreaks of serfs occurred in Russia. Now, I'm sure that was all just spontaneous and coincidental.
Yeah, there's no way that could have been spontaneous.
Maybe they saw it on TV. They saw the looting and shooting, and they decided they would go take part. Someone had to tell them to be where they were at those times.
Right, but the problem is there was no TV.
Exactly. That's why somebody had to tell them, hey, you need to go out here and loot and shoot. Of course, in the pages of official history, we shall find no explanation of this sudden recurrence of the revolutionary epidemic, which is once more conveniently ascribed to the time-honored theory of contagious popular enthusiasm for liberty. Well, how come we haven't seen a contagious popular enthusiasm for liberty today?
Well, because people that pay half their salary in taxes think they're free here.
And they're happy they just part with half of everything they own and have their daughters become whores.
Well, evidently in 1848, Europeans were a lot more learned.
Thus, the Cambridge Modern History, describing the revolution in Germany, observes, "The Grand Duchy of Baden was the natural starting place for the revolutionary movement which once set on foot, seemed to progress almost automatically from state to state and town to town." Precisely, but we are given no hint as to the mechanism which produced this automatic action all over Europe. Well, I'd say it was Jewry. The business of the official historian is not to inquire into causes, but to present the sequence of events in a manner unintelligible to the philosopher, but satisfying to the uninquiring mind of the general public. That the European Revolution of 1848 was the result of Masonic organization cannot, however, be doubted by anyone who takes trouble to dig below the surface. We have already seen how Manzini and the Young Italy movement had proved the blind instruments of the Haute Vente Romane, and how the same society operating through the lodges had prepared the ground in every country. In France, the part played by Freemasonry in the revolutionary movement was quite frankly recognized, and the Supreme Council of the Scottish Rite, presenting themselves before the member of the Provisional Government on the 10th of March, received the congratulations of Lamartine in these words, quote, I am convinced that it is from the depths of your lodges that have emanated, first in the shade, then in the half-light, and finally in the full light of day, the sentiments which ended by producing the sublime explosion we witnessed in 1789, and of which the people of Paris have just given to the world the second, and I hope, the last representation. So they're hoping this will be the revolution to end all revolutions, and it'll just be communism from here to eternity.
Well, obviously it failed, and obviously they had to have a few more revolutions.
But of course, the people were to be allowed to think they had acted on their own initiative. Thus, the Jewish Freemason Krumé, whom the revolution had raised to a place in the provisional government, declared in a speech to the crowd that on the ruins of the shattered monarchy, the people took for the eternal symbol of revolution, liberty, equality, fraternity. Yeah, 4 more years. It was only to the Freemasons themselves, this time a deputation of the Grand Orient, on the 24th of March, that he acknowledged the true origins of this device. In all times and under all circumstances, Masonry ceaselessly repeated these sublime words, liberty, equality, fraternity. In Germany, as in France, the principal leaders of the revolution, Hecker, Fickler, and Herwig, in Baden, Robert Blum in Saxony, Jacobi in Königsberg, von Gagern in Berlin, were all Freemasons who had been present at aforesaid Masonic Congress in 1847. The 1848 revolution was thus the second great attempt of Illuminized Freemasonry to bring about a world conflagration. But there was one country where the movement proved completely abortive. This was England. It is true that for many years the Chartist riots had created widespread anxiety, but the independent character of the English people had hitherto always prevented them from modeling their agitations on continental precedents. In the People's Charter, aiming rather at political reform than at social disintegration, was essentially a national product.
Do you think it's the independent character of the English people? Because I think that it's the hold that the Rothschilds already had on England.
So why burn down your own house?
Right. That's the way I look at it.
That agitators working for the overthrow of the existing social system had introduced themselves into the movement as earlier they had found their way into the trade unionism cannot be doubted. It was this, however, that led to the final defeat of Chartism. When on the 13th of April, 1848, a great demonstration was organized and a monster petition carried to Kennington Common, London prepared itself for self-defense and prudent tradesmen put up their shutters in expectation of riots. But the insignificant proportions of the assembled mob and the discovery that a great number of the signatures appended to the petition were fraudulent, covered the whole affair with ridicule, and the dreaded explosion ended in smoke. The truth is that in a country where reforms were in progress, revolution could make little headway, and the passing of the 10 Hours Bill in 1847 had done much to quell agitation. Moreover, as we have already seen, the cooperative movement had begun and was taking a strong hold on the imagination of the British workers. It is not a little to the credit of our country that whilst France continued to turn in a vicious circle of abortive revolution, the English people, true to their traditions, had struck out a fresh path entirely on their own initiative, which but for socialist opposition might have led and may yet lead to the regeneration of the industrial system. Thus, the situation stood at the end of 1848. Socialism in every conceivable form had been tried and found wanting. It had failed in the form of peaceful experiments under Robert Owen, Saint-Simon, Fourier, Pierre Leroux, and Cabet. It had failed still more signally when the attempts were made to establish it by revolutionary methods. So we find that at this crisis, a change came over the revolutionary movement and socialism. A derelict concern was taken over by a company. What that company was, we shall see in the next chapter.
Which we may have to do before we go to World War II.
All right.
Because she talks about the roles of the Jews in Germany and German social democracy in Marx and Engels in her next chapter. And I was hoping she would have covered that material in this chapter, but evidently there was just too much material.
Okay, and that's a wrap for now then? We'll pick up sometime in the next few weeks?
Well, yes, we'll resume this program when your personal business is taken care of, and you could get back to it. I think you should announce that we'll be taking a hiatus from this program for some
time. All right. This program will resume sometime in mid to late August, most likely, and I hope everyone will keep posted. I will send out email notices about that to everyone on my mailing list, and maybe I'll make a post in your forum about that.
Well, yes, but I really would like to follow this through and back into, and I think we've covered basically the history of communism and socialism and where it comes from. It comes from the Jews. It comes through the secret societies. They agitate through the Masonic lodges and other organizations they have infiltrated in order to agitate for communism. Once they win over enough of the middle classes and influential people in each community to their cause, they carry through their plans. They overturn society, and it leads to anarchy, and they take over. And that's what they did in Russia, and that's what they've done in a very slow method all throughout the West when their French revolutions failed, and they realized that they couldn't do it instantly. But it's the same route. I mean, they became Fabian socialists.
They're just biding their time. Well, Satan's very patient, isn't he?
Well, it's going to follow the same route to anarchy. There is no doubt. It's just in 100 years instead of a year. But it's still going in the same path. You could look at the history of this country over the last 100 years and see the slow descent into Bolshevism. We're about there now.
And then we'll tie it back in with Hitler probably in late August or early September is when we'll get back into that, correct?
I hope so.
All right. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.
Thank you.